Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Go For It. I'm your host, Paul Gann, alongside Jeremy Esme. And for the next 2 hours, we will be talking sports and having fun doing it. I want all your ideas, all your opinions, and all your beliefs. And, of course, as always, you will get a heavy dose of our opinion. If you have an opinion, the number to call, 646-727-3070. That's 646-727-3070. You can listen to the show at blogtalkradio.com/pgann. That's blogtalkradio.com/PGAN, and you can send messages to the show on Twitter at GoForItGAN. And if you please, you can follow me on Twitter at GoForItGAN as well. Expected again to be joined by Willie Rofe, the great Willie Rofe. We're going to talk some NFL football with Willie Rofe. Also, we're going to be joined by Victor Butler of the Dallas Cowboys. They prepare for a big football game against the Buffalo Bills. And also Chris Herron, a former NBA star who there was a documentary recently out on him, ESPN 30 for 30 documentary about his life and trials and his times. And this man has a great story, a very great story, overcame drug abuse and everything. I mean, this man has a great story. So make sure you stick around for that. Chris Herron will be joining us in the 2 o'clock hour, Victor Butler in the 1 o'clock hour, and Willie Rofe will be joining us in the next 10 minutes. But, of course, we have to start in Happy Valley. Unhappy Valley at this point. Joe Paterno fired Wednesday. The president fired Wednesday as well. And this is all centering around the sex scandal at Penn State with Jerry Sandusky, who was indicted on 40 charges of sexual abuse. And then basically Jerry Sandusky, according to the grand jury report, has been molesting kids and doing some unsavory things to children for the last 14 and 15 years, for a very long time, And, I mean, this is what we know. I mean, the guy has been involved with the Second Mile organization, he founded for children with issues, children who are having family issues, children who are having problems. And this man has been around children since 1977 with that organization. So there's no telling how many more allegations may be out there, and allegations probably will be popping up left and right before
Paul,
this whole thing is done.
Did you get a chance, you know, to talk to your children? I mean, I know we've interviewed ours because, you know, at this point, and it's a public service announcement, you know, I would sit down. I mean, that man, he is far-reaching, you know, a lot of co-conspirators.
I mean, yes, and it's important to definitely – and if there's one thing we learned from this, it's very important to talk to your children, because child molesters, the one thing they do is they find a way to get around children. So, I mean, talk to your children, watch your children, and watch the company that they keep. But you look at this whole situation, Joe Paterno done at Penn State after 46 years, 46 great years, and unfortunately it had to end this way. And you never want to see a guy of his status and his stature go out the way he went. You never want to see, you always want to see a legend go out on his own terms. You always want to see a legend go out the right way.
Yeah.
And I look at it this way. I mean, I thought Joe Paterno should have been able to coach this Saturday, but if I was Penn State University, I would have done the same thing, and I would have fired Joe Paterno because of the backlash that is coming from the public. I mean, there's no way you could have put him out there with all this going on. There's no way you can do it. Now, Joe Paterno has acknowledged maybe he could have done more, and probably he should have done more. But you look at it, it's not like he did nothing. I mean, he did report what happened.
Oh.
He did report the incident to his superiors.
Oh.
Could he have done more? Yes. But Mike McQuarrie, the guy who was a grad assistant at the time, who allegedly saw the events back in 2002, saw apparently Jerry Sandusky doing some unsavory things to a young boy in his shower, Mike McQuarrie saw it. Mike McQuarrie obviously distraught, very distraught. He didn't know what to do. He didn't know what to do. He did call his daddy. He called his daddy. But let me. I want to go to that real quick. I want to go to that. And everybody is always quick to say, oh, I would have did this. I would have ran in and stopped this. I would have ran in and done that. I would have did this, that, and the third. Let's be clear about something. Mike McQuarrie at the time was a grad assistant. So if he goes and just say Mike McQuarrie sees this incident and immediately calls the cops. If he does that, what happens to Mike McQuarrie? You think Mike McQuarrie's on the Penn State coaching staff in 2011? If he does that? And people are so, and everybody's saying, yes, does Mike McQuarrie have a moral obligation to call the cops after that type of situation? Yes, he does. He does have a moral obligation. But if you look at it, everybody is so easy for us to say, if I was in his shoes, I would have called the cops or I would have went in there and stopped it. I would have did this, that, and the third. And I think it's so easy for us to say that. But let's look at it. Let's truly look at it. If you're in a position where you're trying to be a coach on the Penn State staff and you see a situation which could ultimately affect you being a coach on that Penn State staff, albeit it's selfish, but he did what he felt was the right thing to do at the time.
I think
Joe Paterno felt and did what he thought was the right thing at the time. But was there a cover-up? You could argue that this whole thing has been covered up for years. But sometimes, you know, people who are child molesters, people who are doing unsavory things, find a way to hide it from all of us. And they do a good job of it.
Well, Paul, I mean, you're almost, again, and ever the apologist. I mean, soon must be you'll probably be a song out here for Save Joe Pa. You tried to save McNabb, and, you know, and Willie will come on shortly and again reiterate that you saved nothing because his career was over 2 years ago, as I said. But, I mean, so you're happy with the, you know, look, if you, again, now, that's what we're supposed to do. We have to look back at this. We're not able to look at this, you know, concurrently. Our job is to look back at this. So you're saying
sure.
Legend Joe Paterno. You believe you call and you say he is a legend. You believe he acted like a legend, Paul? I mean, his behavior in this was legend-like. He was a legend.
Well, legally he did what he had to do. Morally, he did not.
Well, Paul, let's say this. Legally, we haven't figured that out yet. Legally,
at this point, Joe Paterno has not been charged with anything, and more than likely, probably will not be charged with anything. He followed the chain of command. He followed the chain of command.
And
what happened after you followed the chain of command is what happened.
So by not going to the police, Paul, you're saying by not going to police, you know, you see what he did and you think that what he did was appropriate.
I'm saying I can't get in the mind of Joe Pa because I'm not Joe Pa, but I'm saying at the time maybe he thought what he was doing was the right thing to do at the time. And in hindsight, one thing about hindsight is very 20/20, and everybody can say after the fact what they would have done, obviously, because it's very easy because it's already happened. But in the heat of a moment, Joe Paterno made the decision that he made. And he probably had time to ponder the situation. He definitely had time to ponder the situation, but he made the decision that he made, and he thought it was the right decision at the time. And let's be clear about something about Jerry Sandusky. To that point, 2002, the man has not been charged with anything. He was not charged with anything. So theoretically, if we want to talk the law, the man is an innocent man, and the man still is an innocent man to this point. Now, do I think he committed these crimes? Yes. Do I think he did all the things that they put in the grand jury report? Yes, I think the man did those things. So let's be clear about that. But this is America, and in America – you know, there's a thing called innocent until proven guilty. And as of right now, as we speak, and many people have been indicted in life and not been found guilty. But as we speak right now, the man is innocent. Jerry Sandusky I'm talking about, he's innocent. But do I think he did these crimes? Oh, yes, definitely. 100% I do believe he did them. But at this point, we have to say that we are, everything we're talking about this case is all alleged. and everything in terms of this, these crimes are alleged. But again, do I think he did it? Yes, I do. I do think he did it, and it's kind of hard for me to believe that Joe Paterno and the rest of Penn State University did not know that Jerry Sandusky had these type of issues. But you never know. You never know.
Well, maybe Joe Pot thought
he was doing the right thing.
Well, I mean, you're not going to say that. You really believe? I mean, see, Pot. Honestly, like it angers me that you're going to sit here and even attempt to rationalize or apologize or even accept the fact that when someone walks into your office and you're a head coach of an institution like Penn State, I mean, you have to remember. Paul, you have to make this situation whole when you're talking about this. This is not, little sisters at a poor university. This is Penn State University, 1999. Penn State was and still remains. A national perennial powerhouse. 99, Paterno was the same living legend he is today. When this man walks into your office and tells you he witnessed your defensive coordinator, heir apparent, sodomizing a young, under 10-year-old.
Let's clear something up. 2002, Jerry Sandusky, when McQuarrie brought this to Joe Paterno, Jerry Sandusky was no longer defensive coordinator for Penn State University. He left back in 1999. So let's be clear about that.
But let's understand. I mean, before leaving, and you know as well as I do, according to timelines that have been reported, there were incidents that he was already taken off of these charitable boards that he sat on, and there were complaints of inappropriate, at that point it was inappropriate touching or hugging. So again, I mean, this at that point, and that's what I'm saying, if all of this was shielded from Joe Paterno, at that day when that man walks in, and now I'm saying to you, you put yourself in that man's shoes. You have children. You have to remember, Paul, Joe Paterno has a son who now actually is on the coaching staff. This young man who's in his early 20s, a graduate assistant, tells you he witnessed this. You don't at that point realize that, yes, maybe Paul, at that point it goes right to the authorities. How does it not go to, getting law enforcement involved?
Joe Paterno, would be the first to – he did acknowledge in his statement that he did not do what he should have done. But he did do something. Let's just not say he did not do nothing.
He did do something.
Did he do enough? Obviously not. No, he did not do enough. But everybody is so quick to say I would have did this and that. But let's be clear about something. If I report, let's just say we see an incident and we report the incident. Just say we see something on her jobs and one of our coworkers is doing something inappropriate to a young child. Just say we report that to our superiors. At that point, it's the superior's jobs to do their job. And whether they don't do their job or not, how often are you really going to check on that to see if they did their job? How often are you going to check to see if they did their job? But let's be honest about this. Joe Paterno is Penn State football. And with that being said, Joe Paterno really did not have to go that high up. He really just had to go to himself, and he really had to just take it to the police at that point, and they could have did what they had to do. He didn't do it. And because of that, Joe Paterno is not coaching this Saturday against Nebraska. Let's bring in now one of the greatest offensive linemen to play the game, the one, the only, Mr. Willie Rowe.
How y'all doing today?
How are you, Willie?
Well, how are you?
Good.
Willie, you want to add anything about this Penn State situation?
Well, I just like to say, if the coach saw, the assistant coach saw, whatever going on, all this should have been addressed, 10 years ago. And Paterno was bigger than the president at that university. So, that coach should have been, as soon as anybody knew anything was going on in any aspect dealing with those kids, he should have been fired or reprimanded at that time. It shouldn't be 10 years later that we're dealing with this.
But Willie, let me ask you this. I mean, you played on two major NFL teams, and you were around the NFL. Penn State, it was almost a football team. If someone went to a head coach in the NFL, could this have stayed under wraps? Can this kind of stuff not get out there to other coaches, players? I mean, was this something that could have been covered up, like the media reports?
Well, I don't know. But you're not going to have a bunch of kids running around with a coach in the NFL environment. You might have a family day with the team's families, but, you know, anytime you got a grown man, like the coach is walking around with a whole bunch of little different kids, doing stuff for them and having them in a personal setting, you have to start questioning what's going on. Now, if he has the kids in groups and he's taking them different places and with a whole group and doing group functions with the kids, that's one thing. When you have a man walking around with individual kids, a lot of the time, I mean, people have to notice and see that going on.
And definitely. I think as much as, you know, Joe Pa is a legend and all that, I think on some level there was a cover-up here. I think people knew that Jerry Sandusky had these issues. I just think people tried to just poo-poo it away, and unfortunately, it obviously is the wrong thing to do, and unfortunately, Joe Paterno has lost his job, and many would say rightfully so. And Willie, let's move to the NFL now. Eli Manning and the New York Giants, Eli Manning said this offseason that he is an elite quarterback. You can put him up there with the likes of Brady, Rodgers, and his brother Peyton. Eli is playing some good football, had a great comeback victory against the Patriots last weekend. Is Eli an elite quarterback in the National Football League?
Yes, Eli is an elite quarterback. Eli Manning has a Super Bowl ring, and Eli Manning is playing excellent football this year, so I would have to agree with that. I would say Eli Manning is an elite quarterback this year, and hopefully he can keep it going. He's had some years where he's thrown some picks and had some down years, but he is an elite quarterback and playing at a real high level this year.
And he is an elite quarterback this year, but would you say in general next year, going into next year, you would put Eli in that elite quarterback status even after coming off a 20-plus interception season a year ago?
Yeah, he's having a great year, and I will say if they keep the receivers around Eli Manning, he will be an elite quarterback. As long as he got the weapons he has, he's going to be playing pretty good.
And Eli is definitely playing pretty good. The New York Giants are playing pretty good. They're 6-2 on top of the NFC East, and they got a big football game against the San Francisco 49ers this weekend. And Willie, let's go to Philadelphia now. The Dream Team Eagles lost to the Chicago Bears Monday night. They fall to 3-5, tied for last place in the NFC East. In my mind, I look at the Philadelphia Eagles. They have to go at least 7-1 the rest of the way, and that'll get them 10 wins if they want to have a shot to make the playoffs. But Willie, in your mind, are the Eagles finally done? Can we stick a fork in them?
Yeah, the Eagles are a disappointment, man. I mean, the Eagles have not played consistent all year. The Eagles have, you know, one week they play great against Dallas, then they come out there. I don't know what Andy Reid's doing. I mean, he's not running the football. It seemed like they're discombobulated this week. They never got in the rhythm. I don't know what they were trying to do last week. I mean, the Eagles have been a disappointment this year. I can't, you know, Vic hadn't played as good as he would have played, but they've just been a disappointment this year.
And definitely a very big disappointment in Philadelphia with the Eagles. But with that being said, I'm still not counting this football team out, and I think the talent is definitely still there.
Y'all got to cut them out. Hey, man, you got to cut them out sooner or later because they're just not performing as consistently, man. I mean, come on. They got to do something.
Well, and more than that, Willie, and I think, you know, I think, again, you can speak on this. This is a team that certainly added a lot of pieces, but they clearly are not adding the right pieces or the pieces they need. They have no real offensive line to support a quarterback like Michael Vick, and they don't have a linebacking core. They may have a couple of players on their front four that can rush the quarterback, but they can't stop the run, and they have no linebackers.
Well, I mean, I thought the team, it's the middle of the season. I thought the team would have been playing better now. The team has not progressed, and by now, they said they were going to mix up coverages with the defense and all that, but they should be playing better football. That's the middle of the season. We can say they put the team together, but it's the middle of the season now. They should be playing football. Deshaun Jackson is worried about his contract. I mean, he disappeared all year this year.
And you brought up Deshaun Jackson, and I wanted to get your not just take on him, but Deshaun Jackson versus, for example, a player like LeSean McCoy coming into this season. It was all Deshaun Jackson, all about his contract, and now you have a guy, LeSean McCoy, who arguably has really, I mean, I think he has stolen the media attention, not just from him, but I think nationally. I think people are looking at him and saying, this is a guy, you know, predominantly one day could lead the league in rushing.
Yeah, I just don't understand what they've been doing. One week they play good, one week they run the football, and they go back to doing different things. And like I said, Dick has been inconsistent this year. Now, I mean, he played great last year for most of the season, but it's just been weird kind of watching him play this.
And you talked about it, the inconsistency is just up and down, up and down. And they were down definitely against Chicago this past week. And Willie, other news around the NFL, Albert Haynesworth get cut by the New England Patriots this week, but he's picked up by the Tampa Bay Buccaneers, and he says he's happy to be in a 4-3 defense again. Will Albert turn it around, or is Albert Haynesworth the guy who just took the money and ran?
I talked to Paul about this, and Haynesworth, he's not a professional. I mean, he doesn't look like he's in any shape. He's got three tackles. I don't care if he's playing in 3-4, 2-2, 4-6. He's got three tackles in six games. He doesn't practice half the time till he said his back hurt or some crazy illnesses. I mean, I wouldn't have picked Haynesworth up. And, he's had so many opportunities. You know, since he signed that contract with Washington, he hasn't done anything. So, I mean, I don't see Haynesworth turning it around. He doesn't look like he wants to play. He doesn't even look like he wants to play football.
And do you think Ocho Cinco is next at some point, or do you think he lasts the whole season?
Well, I think Ocho Cinco's got a bigger contract, and I think they're going to need him to spread the field come later in the season if they're going to do anything. I mean, they got Deion Branch, and they have Wes Welker possession receiver, but they're going to need to stretch the field, so I think he's going to be there.
And Willie, a team that you had in the Super Bowl and it's at the start of the season, New York Football Jets, this team was dead weeks ago, a three-game winning streak. They're making teams turn the football over, 8 turnovers in the last 3 games. They're shutting teams down, only 38 points during this three-game winning streak. They beat the Chargers. They beat the Bills last week. Right now they're tied for first place. Willie, are the Jets back?
Right now. And what you call it can stay healthy. Plaxico's starting to get in shape. Plaxico's starting to play a lot better. So, the way they look good. You know, they're running the ball. And it looks like they're going to be a good team. And they're hitting their stride right now. So, they look good to me.
So, do you think moving forward that the New York Jets win the AFC East?
Yes, I think the New York Jets win the AFC. That's still my pick.
and you look at it, the New England Patriots. I think it's a legitimate pick. You look at the New England Patriots; they've been struggling of late, and the Bills they're coming back to earth a little. So it looks like, and I can't believe I'm saying this, but the New York Jets may win the AFC East. And they're getting some, like you said, Plaxico's playing well, and Mark Sanchez is playing well as well. I mean, he's getting it done, too, for the New York Jets. And they're 5-3, and they got the momentum with them, and they're playing some good football. We'll see what happens this week against the Patriots. Big, big game. Willie, every week we got to get your top five. I think the top five is definitely going to change a little bit. A lot of movement going on. So, Willie, what's your top five?
All right, well, my top five this week, Green Bay still number one. Nobody slowed them down. San Francisco's number two, 7-1, playing some great football up there, and they're going to be tough to deal with. New York Giants, number 3 after the big win they had last week. Baltimore, number 4 after going into Pittsburgh and winning that game. And the New York Jets are my number 5 team.
Wow. There's a lot of things I have issues. Got a lot of issues with this top 5 this week. Issue number 1, San Francisco ahead of Baltimore.
Who's ahead of Baltimore?
San Francisco being ahead of Baltimore.
I got them ahead of Baltimore. They're 7-1 right now. I mean,
so
really, I can't trust Flacco every week.
So you're telling me that you believe that the San Francisco 49ers at this point are a better team than the Baltimore Ravens?
I'm saying right now because they haven't played each other, and I'm saying if they do play each other, it's going to be in the big games. Alex Smith has been playing better than Flacco. Week in, week out. Who's got the better running back?
Well, it's hard. Ray Rice, Frank Gore. I mean, it's pretty much a wash.
Okay, well, Flacco, I don't trust.
No, it's not a wash, Paul. Come on.
You trust Alex Smith.
Well, I mean, Paul, you have to remember, you're trusting Alex Smith, but this is a new system, and this is really, I have tried to tell you this. This is really a system that he fits in. This is a guy that has really played very consistently throughout the season. I think for you not to recognize that he has played, this is the same Alex Smith all season. There are not these pushback games as you have seen in prior seasons. And they have a very, very, very strong offense. I don't think people understand. Crabtree is coming into his own. I mean, Frank Gore is nothing to sneeze at. And they arguably have one of those underrated tight ends in the game.
Well, I don't know about a strong offense, but they do have a pretty strong defense. Their defense is playing very well. And I think that's one of the reasons.
The 49ers run the ball every game. Frank Gore has 5 straight games with 100 yards rushing.
Ray Rice is no slouch.
Well, okay, but I'm saying as far as production, I think the offensive line for San Francisco has done an excellent job. Now, where they're going to get in trouble, maybe, is having somebody stretch the field. Unless Crabtree steps up, they don't throw the ball down the field. And Flacco has that young receiver, the one they drafted, who I thought was going to get better as the year goes on, and he ended up beating the Pittsburgh Steelers. That's the difference actually between the two teams right now is that the tight end, I guess the tight end advantage to the 49ers, and they have some possession receivers, but they don't have anybody that can stretch the field.
And I got another problem here, Willie. Pittsburgh Steelers, they move out?
Pittsburgh Steelers had to move out. Baltimore beat them at home. I mean, I got the Giants go in and beat. The Giants have been playing real good football, and they go in and beat the New England Patriots at home and stop a 30-game winning streak at home. And then I got the Jets have been playing the best football in the AFC. So, I mean, how can I can't have Pittsburgh's out. Pittsburgh's in the maybe 6, 7. I don't even have the Saints in the top 5 now.
I can live with that. I can live with the Saints not being in the top 5. But I think the Packers, obviously, number 1. But I think the Ravens belong 2. I think the Steelers belong 3. I think the Niners belong 4. And I think the Giants belong 5. I think the Giants at this point are a better football team than the Jets.
Who's 2?
Who?
Who's number 2?
I got the Ravens number 2.
You got the Steelers. You got the Steelers number 3. You got the
I think the Steelers still belong in there.
What about the Jets?
What's that?
What about the Jets?
Jets don't belong in there yet. I'll see what happens this week.
Come on,
We'll see this week. If you beat the New England Patriots, then I think you slide into that top 5. But at this point, I'm not putting the Jets in the top 5.
Well, we'll see what happens this week. I know this.
Well, we'll definitely see what happens.
The Philadelphia Eagles, we're going to have to start talking about what we're going to do about the coaching situation real soon in Philadelphia. We don't get stuff going right. We've got to talk about the coaching situation up there because the team should be playing better. They have all the talent, you know, and they've just been too inconsistent. So I need some discipline in Philly. The team does not look disciplined.
I would agree with you. I mean, they have not played disciplined football. All those turnovers and the way they played, it's just not disciplined football. I would agree with you. And I would say that I think a very legitimate argument could be made that if the Eagles don't make the playoffs, I think Andy Reid does need to go. It's just too much talent on this roster for them to be underachieving the way they are.
Way too much.
I would agree with you on that. I definitely would agree with you on that. And maybe we'll see. I mean, I think if once the Eagles become eliminated from the playoffs, the playoff race, I think we're going to start talking whether or not Andy Reid deserves to come back. And if they don't make the playoffs, I don't think he deserves to come back.
Well, it's going to be tough. I mean, you got all this talent. You got paying Michael Vick all the money. You got Deshaun Jackson, who doesn't even look like who wants to play anymore. So
Who are they replacing?
What defense are we going to play? We pick up all these cover corners and we're playing zone. I mean, you got to figure things out.
And Jeremy, you said the question: who are they replacing him with? But who was Andy Reid when they hired him many years ago? Your question was that who would they replace him with? If you have that mentality in life, you'll never get anywhere. Everybody's replaceable, and there's always somebody out there. So that's not a legitimate argument to me. You look at it many years ago when the Philadelphia Eagles hired Andy Reid. Andy Reid was not a big name. Andy Reid was not a big name. So who can they bring in to replace Andy Reid? There's somebody out there.
But Paul, my point is it was a kickoff of what Willie said. You have to remember, Paul, you're talking about bringing in a guy. When they brought in Andy Reid, who was their starting quarterback?
I would agree with you, but the point is, I let you talk.
Let me talk.
But hold on, your question, you're going away from the question. Your question was, who can they replace him with? And I said to you, who was Andy Reid many years ago? He was a nobody. Everybody can be replaced.
Yeah.
And there's always somebody out there.
First series record.
3-5.
3-5. Hey, they've got, I mean, something's going to have to give.
I would agree. If they don't turn this around and they don't make the playoffs, I think replacing Andy Reid should be in a discussion. I think definitely it should be in a discussion.
Well, I mean, Paul, I think that you can talk about the discussion, but you're thinking with your emotions. Especially in this offseason, they commit so much dollar value to Andy Reid's system. You are not going to be able to tell me, especially when you re-sign a Michael Vick to a $100 million contract, bringing in unless it is a promotion like within, or bringing in a guy that is very familiar, if not, again, an Andy Reid disciple out in the league, what are you doing with this offense? And as Willie said, you had a defense that arguably is just, in complete shambles. But again, just like they brought in Morningweg, they could very easily in the offseason go out and look, tell Andy Reid, just like they've done in the past, we're going to bring in Morningweg a couple years ago when the offense needed some help. We're going to go out and bring a big-name defensive coordinator in here, an ex-head coach, and really give you what you had with Jim Johnson, which is a guy who can handle the defensive side of the ball and let you focus on what you do best.
Well, the point is, Andy Reid has been at it for a long time now, and 5 NFC title games, 1 Super Bowl appearance. At some point, you have to, if it's not working, it's not working. And at some point, you got to bring in a different voice. You look at the Tampa Bay Buccaneers many years ago, they kept getting to that point with Tony Dungy, but they needed to bring in somebody who could get them over the top. The person that got him over the top was not Tony Dungy. It was what Tony Dungy's talent, but it was not Tony Dungy. It was John Gruden. So the way I look at it here, if the Philadelphia Eagles do not make the playoffs, and you're talking about if they're not going to make the playoffs, it's probably going to win what? Probably be 8-8, maybe 9-7 at best. If they don't make the playoffs with this roster and this type of talent, heads need to roll, and one of those heads that need to roll is Andy Reid. He was the guy who brought in Juan Castillo, the guy who was an offensive line coach, never coached defense many moons ago, but never on the NFL level, and even not even on the collegiate level, and now we're bringing him back. We bring him in as the defensive coordinator. The guy hasn't done it in a long time, and the defense has been poor, and the defense, quite frankly, is one of the reasons this team is 3-5. Heads need to roll if the Philadelphia Eagles do not make the playoffs. It needs to roll.
Yeah, I mean, how much are they giving up a game? Were they giving up 30? How much are they giving up a game?
I don't have the point how much they're giving up, but I know that they're near the bottom and they're close to the bottom in run defense. And you look at Matt Forte; he had an impressive game against the Philadelphia Eagles. And you look at they didn't even get a sack on Jay Cutler. You talk about a guy who gets sacked all the time.
Yeah, they didn't get one sack on Cutler. First game, yeah, he hadn't been sacked in a long time.
Right. So something's wrong. Something is not right here. And if they don't make the playoffs, I think heads have to roll. And one of those heads is Andy Reid. Willie, as always, it's been a pleasure. Let's do this again next week. And that top five, Willie, I got a lot of issues with. But we'll see how it plays out.
We'll see how it plays out. We got to get your picks, Paul. We're waiting on your picks. Me and Gil, we're waiting on your picks for this week.
I'll get them to you. I'll get them to you.
All right.
All right.
Yeah, take it easy.
All right. The great Willie Rofe. Interesting top five picks, I think. I mean, got some issues with it. Some issues with that top five. I really do. I mean, the Jets, do they belong in the top five? And do the Steelers go out after, I mean, you're playing the Baltimore Ravens, and it was a tough football game. You go out because of that? You go out of the top five? I don't know. I don't know about that one. I got some issues with that. But it is what it is. And Jeremy, let's go back to this. Let's go back to this Andy Reid discussion and the Philadelphia Eagles right now. They're a struggling football team, 3-5, and everybody you're talking to out here, they're saying it's pretty much over. And you can make a legitimate argument that it is over and that their opportunity to make the Super Bowl or the playoffs, I should say, not the Super Bowl. We got to talk playoffs first.
Well, it's over. I mean, let's put this to bed. Let's keep moving. It's over. So you could be in love with Philadelphia. You could be in love with whatever you want. But the season is over. So that being said, I mean, where are we going here next?
So you're saying it's over. No playoff berth for the Philadelphia Eagles.
I mean, come on, Paul. This team, that's why I will say this, and I mean this. Am I saying that Andy Reid should not be realistic and recognize, you know, especially as Florida, both of you and I are proud Philadelphia Eagle fans, or were at one point. This is embarrassing. I mean, this team with this kind of talent, I mean, certainly the media got very carried away, and you and I talked about it over the summer that I very much felt like this team was not going to be successful, you know, this year, and I don't think they're going to be successful until they really take a look at the fact that you invested $100 million in your quarterback. Who are you investing on your offensive line? Can you invest $100 million in your quarterback? What then are you doing on the defensive side of the ball? Yes, they got the greatest free agent that was out there who drops interceptions, you know, kind of like the receivers drop passes. So, I mean, this has been, and I agree with Willie Rofe, you have 400 million quarterbacks and you're in a zone defense. I mean, this is a team to me that is certainly in a crossroads. But I look at it and say, you know, I think that, again, it seems like very cyclical that this organization relies too much on one central person, and that's Andy Reid. And I think time and again, you know, Andy Reid has kind of been shown that he can sometimes let emotions rule better decision-making. Bringing in Morning Red was I think, very stabilizing for this offense over the last couple of years. And I don't think anyone does appreciate, I think, what he's been able to do to complement Andy Reid and to complement this offense. On the defensive side of the ball, I mean, once the loss of Jim Johnson occurred, it has just been a downhill spiral. And this year, I mean, it's the spiraling is, in my opinion, I would say it's out of control. It looks like a defense that doesn't, I mean, from play to play, Paul, they just don't even seem to have a feel for inside of a four-down set.
Well, it's a defense that is definitely struggling. You can't stop the run, and that's a problem. And all you had to do against the Chicago Bears, who was their biggest weapon? Who's the biggest weapon of the Chicago Bears? Matt Forte. Matt Forte is the guy. He's their offense. He is their offense. I think it was something like 40% of his offense, 40% of the offense is Matt Forte. He is the offense.
Right.
You couldn't stop him.
Well,
you don't stop him.
But that's because, Paul, again, how are they going to stop him? With no defensive tackles and no linebacking core.
Well, Colin Jenkins was supposed to be that guy to, in terms of the interior lineman, who was supposed to bring in some toughness and then help this team stop the run. Obviously, he's not been the guy to this point. Mike Patterson has not played very well to this point. And they're struggling. They're struggling. They're definitely struggling on the defensive side of football. And you give the defense credit the past 2 weeks. They played very well. They played well against the Redskins. They played very well against the Cowboys. But now, you look at what happened this week against the Bears. They've taken a step back. They definitely have taken a step back. And that's an issue. They definitely have taken a step back. And that's a problem. That's a big problem. That is a big problem, and one of the reasons the Philadelphia Eagles are where they are. That is 3-5. 3-5. 3-5. I mean, did you ever think in your mind that you would say the Philadelphia Eagles would be 3-5 with all that talent on the roster? Did you ever think that would be the case? Did you that you would,
I would
say that the Philadelphia Eagles are 3-5? I mean, it's amazing.
I think the worst part is, again, and I mean this, I think it's how, really it's how poorly the entire Eagles team played. They're not, it's not one side of either of the ball. This has been a team failure.
It has. And you can, I think majority of the blame goes to defense, but I think the blame does go to the offense. Some blame goes to the offense more so because of the turnover situation. I mean, they've turned the ball over an ungodly amount, and you can't win when you turn the football over that many times, as many times as they did. And you look at the game on Sunday. To me, the turning point was that DeSean Jackson fumble, where at that point the Eagles had just tied the score at 10, and going into the halftime, more likely the score would have been tied at 10. Then DeSean Jackson fumbles the football at an inopportune time, and the Bears recover, and ultimately the Bears score a touchdown. And that's big. That was big. That was the turning point in the game to me, and the Bears go up 17-10 at that point. But the Eagles do tie the score and ultimately take the lead and have a lead in the fourth quarter. And just like against the Falcons, just like against the Giants, and just like against the 49ers, they lost the lead. They lost the lead. And ultimately, the Chicago Bears took it from there. And ultimately, Chicago Bears won the football game. And it's not good. It's not a good situation in Philadelphia. The odds are against them. But I'm not willing to say at this point that they're done. I don't think they're done, but the odds are stacked against them. But you think they're done.
Well, I mean, Paul, if you don't think they're done, I mean, honestly, where do you see them turning this around? I mean, considering that they now, again, and when you look at who they're losing to, I'm going to say this. They are better than, or they should be better than the Chicago Bears. I mean, I'm sorry, but if you think that they're going to be able to turn this around and they can't beat the Chicago Bears, then who are they better than, Paul?
That's a great point. I mean, well, the Chicago Bears are, let's be clear about the Chicago Bears. It's not a bad football team. It's not like losing to the Arizona Cardinals, who they play this upcoming Sunday. I mean, the Chicago Bears are not a bad team, but that's a game you got to win at home. That's a game you have to win. If you want to talk playoff, that's a game you have to win. And they lost it. They lost the game. I mean, there's no really other way to say it. And they didn't give away this game per se, but I mean, just they didn't make the plays when they had to make the plays. And that's it. They didn't make the plays when they had to make the plays. And when you do that, you run into problems. And you look at on that that crossing route to Macklin, where he was caught the ball, and I think if he would have stepped, you know, if he would have stayed on his feet, he would have got the first down. But at the same time, the pass wasn't one of the greatest passes, and it was a little high, so that forced him to go up a little bit, and I think that was part of the reason he lost his balance. But I mean, that's a play as a receiver you have to make, and you have to do. You have to do it. You have to make that play. And ultimately, the lack of playmaking at the right times, at the big times, at the big moments, are the reason the Eagles are where they're at. And to me, part of that in terms of the turnovers is coaching. And some of the things you saw, I mean, look at the Buffalo Bill game. Juquay Parker goes off sides. When everybody in the stadium knew that the Buffalo Bills were not going to take that snap. Everybody and their mama knew. Everybody in the stadium, even some of the people in graves knew. Everybody knew. The dead knew. Everybody knew that the Ryan Fitzpatrick and the Buffalo Bills were not going to snap that football, and Juquay Parker goes offside. That's discipline. And to me, that comes down to coaching. That's coaching.
You say it's coaching, and I think a lot of it is. You know, I'll tell you where the coaching really begins is, or where it begins and ends is that it's a factor of the entire philosophy, I think, of this organization. I kind of wonder and struggle with. You certainly saw that during the off season or in the preseason, they tried to be politically correct and not fall into the hype of. Saying that they did not believe that they were a dream team, but it almost looks like they must have been. And the reason I'll say that, and you look at that, is because they certainly, Paul, right now are coming off and looking like that they thought that. I mean, in the words of Denny Green, that they are who we thought they were. I mean, there was a lot of a hype there. So, you know, I wonder when we look at it, you and I, being from Philadelphia, if this organization really, you know, I think behind the scenes wasn't going to think to themselves, well, if ESPN's anointing us, if NFL Network is anointing us, then I think these players too. I don't know how. I mean, certainly the defense needs to be, and the coordinator, I will say this. I don't think you can go much further down the line than this season without there being major changes. Partially because, again, you talk about the financial end of this. There's a lot of money invested in this defense, and right now, this is not, I think, how you want to run run a defense. So when I go in and I say how are they done, they have no ability on defense to stop a team. And on offense, as you said, Paul, they have struggled, I think, drive in and drive out. So where are they going to step up and have a complete game against a real opponent, not against the team, in the Arizona Cardinals? That, sure, they should be beating the Arizona Cardinals, no questions asked. But not, I mean, last week when again, that was a – that was an important game against a real NFL powerhouse. And all he did was show that they are not going to be able to, when it counts, put the game together and play a complete 60 minutes.
Well, I wouldn't call the Bears a powerhouse per se, but that's a game that it's a playoff type of team, playoff caliber team. And that's a game that's a game you win. That's a game you win. And it's really no excuses. All the excuses at this point are gone. Just like Willie said, we're in week 8 of the NFL season. So when do your excuses run out now? I'm talking about gelling and coming together. If you ain't coming together now, more than likely you may not be coming together. So all the excuses are out the window at this point. It's time for the Eagles to stop the excuses, stop all this stuff that we're hearing, and just play football. And I'm not saying they're making the excuses per se, but people are making those type of excuses for them. And those excuses are gone. They're gone. They're gone.
No, I mean,
they're
that's why I look at this, Paul, and I say, honestly, I mean, these excuses to me, are they even really valid excuses? I mean, when you look at this team, I mean, are they really that solid? They have proven in the off or during the season is they do have a lot more pieces that they need than we see.
I mean, they have pieces. The pieces are there. I mean, you can argue at the safety position and the linebackers are not good, and that's a legitimate argument. But I mean, it's a lot of things, and this team should not be 3-5. That's all I know. At worst, they should be 5-3. At worst.
When you say that, Paul, you're saying this team with this talent, I mean, or lack thereof, with no offensive line, with no real defensive linemen, defensive tackles, and or linebackers.
Well, I mean, I think it's still enough talent here. You look at the way these games have ended. What's been the thing that's been killing the Eagles all year? What's in your mind? What's killed the Eagles all year?
I think I honestly will say this, Paul. Their line. I mean, I don't think people really do recognize. And I know a lot has been made on the fact that this is a very young linebacking core. Hus has been a very young linebacking core now for 4 years. I mean, this has been a perennial excuse. They have no linebackers. This is a defense that prided itself on having some of the league's most talented, if not the most talented, linebackers. And now, especially when you look at teams that do have good running backs, And that's where they fail, is they cannot stop. They haven't stopped the run in 2.5 years. Agree or disagree?
They have not stopped the run in a while. They struggled against the run last year, and they struggled mightily against the run this year. I mean, it's not a good situation for the Philadelphia Eagles. But all that being said, I think the defense talent-wise, if schemed correctly, is good enough to have this team where they need to be. I really do. And I think, obviously, the offense is definitely good enough. Offensive line excluded, offensive line is average. But all the other pieces are above average. The wide receivers are above average. The tight end is above average. The running back is above average. The quarterback is above average. All the other pieces are above average. The rest are a little below average. They're definitely a little below average. And there's no arguing that. They are below average. But the offensive line is definitely below average. But I still think, 3-5, 8 games left, I think the Eagles can still turn this thing around. But at this point, there is no more margin for error. The margin for error is gone. And I essentially said that last week, that the margin for error is going, and they erred big time against the Bears. But the margin for error, to me, is gone. You have to come up and win. You have to start winning these games and start beating playoff-caliber teams. And you got to defend your home field. They're not doing that either. They're 1-3 at home. That's not a good football team. You cannot be 1-3 at home. You can't be. And expect to be successful. That's inexcusable. You're 1-3 at home. You got to defend your home, your home field. 1-3 at home. That's bad.
Well, and
that
also,
it
was what, Paul? For how many years was it a staple that, you know, that this organization, you know, you did not come. Philadelphia was almost, if you were in Philly, it was not going to be a guaranteed win. And now, I mean, it's not even about guaranteed wins. I mean, I think a lot of teams have especially figured out this defense, which is run the ball down their throat. you know, don't worry about the pass. The pass will come. The pass will be there, you know, once you run the ball down their throat. And I think the worst part about this cornerback, and William touched on, is you have guys that are, they're man-to-man built cornerbacks, and they have them in situations that are not accentuating their talent level. I mean, they are. You're putting a man-to-man type corner, a shutdown corner, in what, Paul? In a zone, and you're wondering why this is happening.
And Nnamdi, I mean, let's be clear about this. In the offseason, when the Eagles signed Nnamdi Asomugha, I wasn't one of these guys that were who were jumping around and celebrating, because I felt like, you know, it was a lot of money for Nnamdi. And at that point, when you bring in a Dominic Rogers Cromartie, who hasn't played well this year either, but when you bring in him, to me it was just, it wasn't very necessary. It wasn't a necessary situation. And so you look at that, you look at Nnamdi, you bring in Nnamdi, and he has not been very successful this year. Nnamdi has not had a big impact this season for the Philadelphia Eagles. There's no getting around that. There's no getting around that. And you sign Nnamdi to all that money, and you're signing him with the belief that he is Revis, that he is Revis. That's what you're doing. You're signing him with the belief that he is Revis. Is he Darrell Revis? I think it's very evident so far throughout the season that he's not. He's not that guy. He doesn't have that type of impact. He hasn't had that type of impact thus far this season. Nnamdi's been very disappointing, to say the least. He's been very disappointing, and I expected more, and I think many fans expected more of Nnamdi Asomugha. And it's very surprising what has happened. It's very surprising what has happened with these Eagles, and it's surprising. It's definitely surprising. That's all you can say. I'm surprised. And you look at it, the NFC East and the New York Giants, they're playing some good football. And the way Eli is playing, to me, is surprising. When he made those comments that he is an elite quarterback, I snickered. I laughed. You know, Eli Manning, an elite quarterback, with all those interceptions, Eli Manning, an elite quarterback, I just thought it was comical. I thought Eli was joking when he said it. And I said at the time that you could even make the argument that Eli is the third best quarterback in his division, behind Vic and Romo. But now, I can't laugh no more. I got to be honest with what I saw and what I've seen to this point. Eli Manning is playing like an elite quarterback. He is playing like an elite quarterback. And I never thought I would say that. Not in a million years would I have ever thought that I would say that Eli Manning is playing like an elite quarterback. He is an elite quarterback. And I know he won a Super Bowl with the New York Giants. And I know he really doesn't get a lot of credit for winning that Super Bowl. But when it was time to make the plays in that Super Bowl, he made the plays, the David Tyree play, and ultimately the pass to Plaxico Burress that put the Giants up and ultimately led to the Giants' victory. So you look at that. You look at that. It's time to give Eli his credit. Maybe Eli is one of those guys. Maybe Eli is a legitimate elite quarterback at this point of his career. Maybe he is. And it's time for us to give him the credit that he deserves. Eli Manning may just be an elite quarterback in the National Football League. It's unbelievable I'm saying it. And I can't believe what's coming out of my mouth. But it's true. Eli Manning is an elite quarterback in the National Football League. He's playing like an elite quarterback in the National Football
League. But I think again, Paul, we look at him, and I think a lot is too much is made and compared to his brother. I mean, if he didn't have his brother, agree or disagree, certainly we would probably not have to hear so much about, you know, is he or isn't he an elite quarterback.
And I think a part of it is if he was Eli Smith, maybe, you know, we would not be as hard on him. But he is Eli Manning, and he has that Manning name. But, you know, you look at it, and Eli, he's legitimate this year, man. He's playing some good football. He's legitimate. he is legitimate. He's playing some good football. He's getting it done. He's limiting his interceptions. He had 25 interceptions last year. To this point, he only has 6, and he has 15 touchdowns and close to 2,400 yards passing after 8 games. Eli Manning is balling. He is balling. There's no doubt about it. The guy's balling. And then against New England Patriots, you go down the field in a clutch situation, and you get it done. You get it done. He did it the week before against the Miami Dolphins when his team was down, let them down the field, and they scored a big touchdown. Eli Manning is getting it done. He's getting it done. Say what you want about the guy.
But Paul, I'm letting you give him his due, but I mean, I don't know. I guess, again, I think a lot with Eli is overhyped because it's easier to say that he's not an elite quarterback because, again, like you said, if his name was Eli Smith or Eli Jones. I mean, with Eli Manning, you're talking about, I think, too many times, is he as good or, if not better, than Peyton Manning, instead of it being, is Eli Manning an elite quarterback? And I think, you know, hey, listen, Paul, right now, you know, he has no neck injury. He could potentially have more Super Bowl rings than his brother has.
Yeah, I mean, him and his brother, at this point in their careers, both have the same number of Super Bowl titles. They both have the same numbers of Super Bowl titles, and that is one. And it almost seems improbable that we're saying Eli Manning is an elite quarterback, but he sure is playing like one. And like I said earlier, before the season started, I made the argument that Eli was the third best quarterback in his division. Well, it's safe to say he's had a better year than Michael Vick, and it's probably safe to say he's had a better career to Michael Vick to this point. And it's probably safe to say that he's had a better career and a better year than Tony Romo. So Eli is the best quarterback in the NFC East. And the Eli Manning, after 8 weeks of the season, is an elite quarterback, or at least has played like an elite quarterback. He really has. He really, really has. And say what you want to say about the guy, but he's played like an elite quarterback. And I look at that game, the Giants-Patriots, and looking at that football game, I was saying to myself, you knew that Tom Brady was going to lead the Patriots down the field and score a touchdown. You know it. You know it. Everybody in the stadium knew it. I think everybody watching the game knew it. But you didn't know whether or not the New England defense could stop the New York Giants. And Eli, I mean, obviously, you weren't sure the Patriots defense could stop Eli Manning, but you weren't even sure that Eli Manning could just lead this team down the field and ultimately lead this team to victory. And he did it. He did it. And he was precise, and he just moved them down the field. And the Giants right now are 6-2. They have a big game against the San Francisco 49ers in San Francisco. And that should say a lot about who is the second-best team in the NFC. We all know who the best team in the NFC is at this point. That is the Green Bay Packers. There's really no argument there. I don't think you're going to get an argument from anybody. But in terms of who the second-best team in the NFC is, you got to make some arguments. There's going to be some arguments. You can argue the Detroit Lions. You could argue the New York Giants. You can argue the San Francisco 49ers. They are 7-1. And as much as I don't believe in Alex Smith and that team, I can't argue with the record. They are 7-1. 7-1 is 7-1. And it's looking like they'll be able to clinch their division very soon. And they're in a bad division. It looks like they'll be clinching it very soon. And if you look at it, the way if they keep going like this, because of the division they play in, they have an opportunity to get the second seed in the NFC. And who knows? Who knows if the Packers start playing bad or going a little funk? Who knows? The San Francisco 49ers could steal the number one seed in the NFC. Who would ever thought that going into this season? No one. No one. It's amazing. It is an amazing story in San Francisco with Alex Smith. I'm shocked.
Well, I'm surprised and a little saddened to hear you say use the word you're shocked. But, I mean, he's not. You're really trying to say that. I mean, really, he's come out of nowhere. He was. I mean, they projected him to be a pretty darn good NFL quarterback.
Well, he was the number one pick, but
so I mean,
what you saw the last few seasons, you thought he was a very good quarterback or a legitimate quarterback?
No, I mean, I think anyone that's going to sit there and say they knew again after the last couple of seasons that from his number one draft till now that there wasn't some issues is lying to you. But I think clearly, Paul, he has had the flashes that have kind of kept you wondering about him, that made you kind of say, which guy is this? And certainly, I just think that, you know, look, I think Mike Singletary was a great NFL player and probably will be and could be a great assistant coach. But I just don't think there are guys that can be coaches and can't be coaches. And when you look at that, and he went through again, he had a couple of coaches in a couple of years, and that's not easy on players who, by the way, are drafted first round, and it's constant. This is a league of how fast are you going to ascend to the top. And when you don't get out of the gates and don't start well, then it can spiral. And now I think you're seeing, first of all, I think he has, he has an elite coach. And even though this is his first year, he comes from an incredible pedigree, did an amazing job, at Stanford. And you're seeing him come out of the gates with a team that last year people left for dead. This year, I think people have now looked at this and said, wow, you know, maybe there was and there is a different team here. So I don't think it's this far of a reach.
In terms of Alex Smith, I mean it's 7-1. I mean, they are 7-1, and they've had some very good victories. They've definitely had some very good victories. I mean, you go into Detroit, you beat the Lions, you beat the Eagles in Philly. I mean, you beat some pretty decent teams. You beat the Bengals as well. You beat some decent teams. In the game that they lost to the Dallas Cowboys, that was a game they probably should have won. So you've beaten some very good teams, and you can't really argue that fact. But, and they have the defense, but do you think you'll continue to get this type of quarterback play from Alex Smith? Do you think Alex Smith will continue to play the way he's been playing thus far, and do you think that'll be enough in a playoff situation?
Well, why wouldn't it, Paul? I mean, I'll go there and I'll say that. Why wouldn't it? I mean, he is, and again, I mean, this is, I think, a different Alex Smith than either. This may go back to being the Alex Smith that was drafted. He has so far this season, going back to that player, I mean, he is throwing the ball very well, making smart decisions, and I agree with what Willie Rose said. I mean, I think you are really underestimating the value of Frank Gore. I think who can control the flow, not just of an offense, but of a game. I mean, if he gets into a groove, he's not playing with, you know, an unproven guy. Frank Gore is Paul. I think you want to rethink, but Frank Gore is a top flight NFL running back.
No, I wasn't saying that, and let me clarify that. I wasn't saying that Frank Gore was not a very good running back in this league, but I was saying in comparison to Ray Rice, Ray Rice is not far behind. If not, it could be essentially a wash between those two. That was my point there. I'm not saying
not
that Frank Gore
is
far from a bump. Frank Gore is a very good running back in this league, and let's not get that twisted.
I mean,
but I was in comparison to Ray Rice. Ray Rice is comparable, if not.
Well, let me answer this.
He's not too far behind.
But let me ask you this. So yes or no, it's yes or no. Is Frank Gore, what the term I like to use, is he a franchise running back?
Frank Gore is a very good running back in this league, and yes, I think you can make the argument that he is a franchise running back.
So then you have a franchise running back and a darn good offensive line, and I mean, they have an elite tight end. I agree with, listen, they have a couple of small pieces at receiver, nothing I think. No standouts, no studs. But I think their offense is consistent because, A, they can run. When you can run the ball at the level they can run the ball, then I think that you have to realize that puts them a notch above, you know, a lot of teams in the NFL.
I mean, yes, and one thing that's getting lost is their defense. Their defense is playing some very good football, and that's one of the big reasons they are where they are. That's one of the big reasons they are 7-1. That defense has played very well throughout this year. They play very well. They made big plays for this team, some big plays, and have done great jobs against some good offenses throughout this year. But I just look at the quarterback position. And Alex Smith, to me, is a game manager. He's not a game-changing quarterback. Can you use – is this an effective formula when you go up against the likes of the Green Bay Packers? Is this an effective formula against a team like that? I mean, because that's who you're going to have to go through to get to their playoffs. And say what you will about the Green Bay Packers, they are 8-0, but defensively, they give up some points. They do give up some points. But is the Niners' offense good enough to score those points? Are they good enough to score those points? And I think you have to ask yourself some questions about that one.
Well, I mean, I don't disagree. I mean, you know, that ultimately – you have to understand, Paul, I mean, the Niners are going to put the points up, and I agree with you. Their defense is stronger than their offense. I think where they will either succeed or fail here in the latter part of this season, and it's also first-year head coach, first year now this team is really going to be able to make a name for itself and test what it's going to be able to do. Getting into the playoffs for them, you know, I think is a major accomplishment. And should they be able to do that? Should this team continue to be able to get, you know, further and further down the line? At some point, you, though, or fans have to realize, too, this is a rebuilding process. I mean, certainly if just because, you know, they may turn out to make the playoffs, they still – have to grow as a team, grow as a unit, and continue to maturate and add some pieces here. So are they Super Bowl bound or Super Bowl tested? Absolutely not. I mean, can this team, in my opinion, you know, win a playoff game? Yeah, I think they can win a playoff game. But I can also very easily see this team finishing, you know, 10-6, and I can see them finishing 8-8. Because I ultimately think, this, as I say all the time, with these younger teams, with these less traveled into the last 2 weeks of the season, veteran-type teams, been there before, done this, you know, before, and especially with the coaching staff. It's different when you're playing in college football and you're Stanford than when you're, you know, San Francisco 49ers. So I think, you know, that does play a role. Jim Harbaugh's never done this before, and whether he's had success at the collegiate level and at Stanford, it's great, but it doesn't translate into it, especially an organization like San Francisco 49ers. That being said, what they can do, win a playoff game. Where does that put them? Alex Smith, where does it all mean? It means that now next year, and I will agree with you, now next year I think his career is on the line. I mean, if they finish strong, especially if they get into the playoffs, then you have to really consider – now the 49ers and Alex Smith have arrived, and you can't go backwards. Going backwards anymore, I think, then you've really kind of proven this guy is a year-to-year type investment, and it's either there or it's not. And if that's the case, he's not a franchise quarterback, and he'll never win you a Super Bowl.
Well, Alex Smith is not a franchise quarterback. I'll tell you that right now. I don't think we need to wait a year to see that. He's not. He's just not. And I think – franchise quarterbacks winning the playoffs, and we'll see if Alex Smith can win this in the playoffs. I got my doubts. I really do, whether or not he can win these playoffs. I mean, you're talking about a team right now that and they're not doing it with smoke and mirrors. I mean, and it's not like they're beating cream puffs. I said that before. They're not beating cream puffs. They're beating some legitimate football teams. And so let's not take anything away from that. They are beating some legitimate football teams. But I just don't think Alex Smith can get it done for you in the playoffs. I just don't think he can do that. I don't think he is that guy. I don't think he's that guy. I just don't see it. But I could be wrong.
Well, I mean, I don't disagree with you. I think that you have to remember, Paul, I'll say this. Is he, again, we talked just about Eli Manning. Is he a franchise quarterback? I'm going to say no, and I'll say for this reason. He's been established in the league long enough. Can he – now, listen, was Trent Dilfer a franchise quarterback? Never, and he won a Super Bowl. So I think
right.
What you can see about
that's
the
true.
NFL is you could certainly, you know, win a Super Bowl and not be a franchise quarterback. If you can learn to play within a system and ultimately within a system that either is – I mean, an unbelievable offense for you as a system quarterback or with a great defense. Can Alex Smith do both of these? It remains to be seen because, again, he never really has had flashes. And this has not been – well, this has been a career year for him, Paul. This has not been a career year. He's not a standout quarterback.
He's not. And that's my concern when you talk about the San Francisco 49ers. And that's why I was very reluctant to put them in any type of top five. For that reason, because of Alex Smith, and I guess at some point, I mean, obviously I'm going to give Alex Smith his credit because he's had a decent year, and I'm not going to take any credit away from him from that standpoint, but the guy, to me, is just not a guy who is a Super Bowl playoff-winning type of quarterback. But again, Either was Trent Dilfer when he won it. So, that's a fair point. That's a very fair point. But, again, you don't necessarily need to be a franchise, need to have a franchise quarterback if you want to win a Super Bowl. And history has definitely showed us that. You don't have to be a franchise quarterback if you want to win a Super Bowl. And that's the – you don't. You definitely do not. You definitely do not have to be that. You don't. History has shown us that. History has showed us that. It definitely has.
Well, I mean, no, I don't disagree that. Yeah, the system, the quarterback. I mean, here's the bottom line, and with San Francisco 49ers. And the like, they're in a difficult position. They've invested a couple of years in this guy, and now they're, you know, Frank Gore's not getting any older. They got a couple of young receivers. The defense is doing well. He's going to now be tested and multiplied, and that's why I say I give you credit. You can't in this league go 5 years in and now be an established quarterback. I mean, again, every rule has exceptions, but due in large part, I think if you're trying to, if that's what you're going to do, it's going to be a problem for you.
Let's bring in a caller now. Quentin, how are you, sir?
Oh, pretty good. How are you guys doing?
Doing well.
Good. Enjoying your topic. A longtime 49er fan. Grew up in Plainfield, New Jersey. Then I actually moved out to San Francisco with my mom and three brothers. People always found it amazing that I was a fan living in New Jersey. But we had a hometown cat back in the early 70s, Vic Washington. He's out of Plainfield, New Jersey, but he used to play for the 49ers. And then another guy in a neighboring town, Perth Amboy, Bruce Taylor, defensive back for the Niners, early 70s. Anyway, that's my background. I watched them through, you know, the crazy times of the 70s when they were just sorry, and then when they broke into like a Camelot type existence and won 5 Super Bowls. And they had, like, this past decade, they've been down. Now they're up. So I've seen the cycles. And one of their biggest, things that I think they rely on just as a core and a fundamental belief within the team is that anything can happen. And
okay.
It's kind of like a magical ride, and I kind of see that paralleling right now. I kind of see that happening right now. And I think people usually get mesmerized and blindsided because they kind of focus on people's weaknesses, and they're not realizing that everybody's got the potential to be great on this earth. And I'm not saying Alex Smith, for instance, you guys talking about Alex Smith, is going to be great. But he has a potential, and a lot of times people are very vulnerable, very how can I say it? It takes someone else to believe in them to bring that out.
Mm-hmm.
And I think Alex is on track to be the best he can be, whatever that may be. I think it's in all of us that if you get somebody like a coach that says, "Hey, I believe in you," you know, there's just no limit of what a guy can do. Now, as far as winning the Super Bowl and go, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Well, the best you can be, and the best you can be, Alex trying to be the best he can be, is that enough to – it's probably going to be enough to get to the playoffs, but is it enough to win a playoff game?
The way I look at it, I've been watching sports for a long time. It's like, man, anything is possible. If you got a guy – if you got a human being that believes in himself, and you got somebody else believing in them, and they're putting in the practice time to get the fundamental things of their skills together, anything's possible. I've been watching Alex, and just like anyone else, man, he's been frustrating me and my boys for years, man. But I'm looking at this cat right now, and yeah, they're playing it kind of conservative. But to answer your question, I believe it can be. It can be enough. One thing people don't realize about the 49ers this year, and they are basically still in training camp. They are literally still in training camp, being a new coach with no OTAs, no off season, and to perform at this right here, that's pretty good. That is pretty good. And it is,
and there's no doubt about it. But, I mean, when it's – to me, you look at it, you have the Green Bay Packers 8-0, and you have the 49ers right now 7-1. I said that you never know. I mean, being that they are in the NFC West, anything could truly happen here, and that with the Packers, they could trip up, lose two, three games, and then the 49ers, being in the NFC West, they could possibly steal the number one seed. Truly can happen.
Let me say this. I think you said you're going to steal a number one seed from the Packers, Paul, where you can't even see – they have not shown a weakness. And unless you can show me a weakness –
defensively, they have shown you some weaknesses. The teams have scored points against the Packers.
Okay.
They have shown some weaknesses on the defense.
And what I was saying about is about the Niners, part where they are in development with their offense, they can do more. See, and I don't know if I should be saying this, but basically from what I've seen, and this is what I kind of hear glimpses of around the 49ers camp, is that they can score more points. What they do is they sit on Jim Harbaugh, man. This dude is very secretive. He will reveal just enough to win that game because he's thinking about the next game. And it comes across me, look at the stats, it comes across, man, these guys only scored 19 points. These guys only scored 20 points. But in actuality, he could score more points, but he's always thinking about that next game when he feels that this game is solid and in the bag. So this guy is very crafty, and I don't think we've seen even a scratch of the surface. I think at the end of the day, we're going to see some things like, man, you know, I think they know more than what they can. And just looking at these guys, I know they could score more points. And I've seen Alex, even in his inconsistencies, I've seen him open up. But people, I don't know if it's the East Coast bias, but people really forget some of the flashes that he has. They go, oh, he can't bring his team back. No, this cat has brought his team back. This cat was down in the hostile environment of the Philadelphia Eagles, brought these cats back from 20 points plus.
It's true. I'll give you credit on that. But
people forget about that.
My thing is this. Is he good enough to win? And I think we have to go back to this question. Defensively, I think that they're very good defensively. The coaching is solid. The running game is solid. But to me, it all boils down to Alex Smith. And you talked about Philadelphia. He did come back there. But in a playoff atmosphere, in a playoff situation, is he
absolutely
the guy?
Put it like this. I'm not saying, I don't have a crystal ball, but I think he can do it. You know, just looking at sports for a long time and playing sports myself, and just like you walk into a gym, you get the eyeball test and go, this guy, you know, he could do it if he was pushed in the right direction. I'm looking at Alex. It takes a really good coach. It's going to take a really good coach, and I think he really has a good coach, and I think they're being very conservative. But I really think that he can do it. I'm not saying he's the next, he's the second coming, but just looking at him as far as talent-wise, I think he can do it. And the thing people aren't realizing is it's everybody. It's a 49er team. They're in the top stats in most phases of the game. Special teams, I think they got one of the top one or two special teams in the league. They got the best field position starting. They're number one in points not allowed. Number one rushing defense. These stats, it's not. They're really looking at it and saying, hey, you know, we're coming at it with all phases. And I think a lot of people are mesmerized by the word Alex Smith, and people just kind of go into kind of like a blur. And understandably, oh, Alex Smith, I can't get past it. I'm just telling folks, get past it because you may be shocked.
Well, Quentin, we'll see what happens. We definitely appreciate the call, and make sure you call again.
Hey, I appreciate the time, fellas. Take care.
All right. You look at it, and Quentin is a big-time 49ers fan, and he believes in the San Francisco 49ers. And what do you think of all that, Jeremy? I mean, we talked about the Niners here, and to me, we said this numerous times, but it does come down to Alex Smith. It does come down to Alex Smith and what he has to offer and what he can do. I mean, he made some interesting points, but, I mean, at the end of the day, is Alex Smith good enough to get you to where you need to go? And I can't talk Super Bowl in the 49ers, but I can say they could possibly sneak in as the number one seed if things go their way. It's a possibility.
Well, I mean, I told you, Paul, this is the first year of their ascension, if you will, or reascension from you know, this retooling. So are they going to make the playoffs? I mean, I think, again, it is a week-to-week NFL, and they're in the mix. So it gives them that ability. What does it translate into? We'll see. I mean, I think – as every week gets closer, then that's where you will know and you do see, what this team will be made of.
It's too early to tell.
To me, I will say this, and I mean, can you prognosticate? Sure. But if anyone's going out there and tell you that they know this and that, it's too early to tell with this team because for too many years, the one thing they've proven to be is just overly inconsistent.
I will say they will make the playoffs. That's a given. That's just a given. That's a given. But anything more than that, and I made an argument last week, and I was talking about the Philadelphia Eagles and how I made a case to how they could get to the NFC Championship game and ultimately be able to face the Green Bay Packers. And I said if the Eagles win the NFC East and they win their playoff game, they would more than likely go to San Francisco if they were the number two seed. And I like my chances against the San Francisco 49ers. And so that I made that argument that the Eagles could possibly sneak into the NFC Championship game. And, you know, you play the Packers, and once you get there, all bets are off. Anything can happen. That defense in Green Bay has given up a lot of points. And one thing you can say about the Eagles, the past two times they played the Green Bay Packers, they played them very well, and it came down to the final drive. But you look at it, and I say this. I think San Francisco, I think I look at this Niner team, and they're probably going to be the number two seed in the NFC for the playoffs. And that's, again, crazy stuff. Just crazy stuff to even think about saying that. Crazy stuff. Crazy. Absolutely,
no, I mean,
positively crazy.
It's certainly, again, they've done a remarkable job of being able to turn this around. And, I mean, it does go, though, Paul, to show you, the NFL is a season-to-season, week-to-week league. And anyone that – there are the powerhouses, but it just seems like once you – and if you can get into I don't want to say a groove, but you look at certain teams and you get these components. You look at, for example, a good example of this is been latter couple of years is the Chicago Bears. I mean, they have a Jay Cutler, a quarterback that is certainly above average, and they have Matt Forte, again, above average running back. You get these quarterback running back combos, and you have a solid defense. Same with Baltimore Ravens. I mean, you can go across the league and you can see Houston Texans. I mean, you're not going to be the elitist of the elite. San Diego is another example. You can keep yourself relevant by having a quarterback running back tandem. I think that due in large part is greater than 50% of its peer group, and I say that because you're not going to win in today's NFL if you can't control the running game. You're not going to win the NFL if you don't have a quarterback that teams have to game plan for. I mean, if you think you're going to go out there with Matt Hasselbeck, teams can prepare for Matt Hasselbeck. I say that not because, Matt Hasselbeck, especially now, I mean, is not an elite quarterback. He's not on the way up. He's on the way down. I mean, and again, Alex Smith has proven you're going to have to game plan for him. He's not just going, you're not going to blitz him and he's just going to throw you the interceptions as he did for 2-3 years in a row. Now he is going to make you pay, and he's going to make you pay hard if you make the mistake. If he catches you making a mistake, then that will be the end of that drive. He has the weapons. He can throw the screen pass, throw the tight end, an emerging Michael Crabtree, and other receivers. And so they are starting to slowly but surely get their feet underneath of them and become a team that again, is young enough to be relevant and year after year. And then I've drawn a comparison to a Chicago Bears team. Good defense. Jay Cutler is here, is the only quarterback. Matt Forte, I mean, who is – has had a great little career here, and again has vaulted the Bears. Look at Detroit now with a great, albeit a great receiver, but a very young quarterback that has shown flashes of brilliance and a pretty solid running game. So here again is essentially the model for the NFL, and that really has been, the receivers are important. But if you must have a running game, you must be able to run that ball, and you must be able to have a quarterback who's not going to be predictable in that throwing that interception especially the book on Michael Vick early in his career was, you had to force him, to his left, and it's things like that when you don't make these mistakes, and I brought up earlier, Paul. I brought up Trent Dilfer because I believe if you can be a quarterback in this league who knows exactly what he has to do and is able to do exactly what he has to do, you can have your team with a defense that, that is the Baltimore Ravens. You win the Super Bowl. But that takes a lot of discipline for Trent Dilfer to really know that basically his job is not to win football games. His job is to let his defense win the football game. His job is to go out there and do his job, which is what the game plan says. Nothing more, nothing less. Not looking to throw Hail Marys, not looking to reinvent himself, not looking to get another big contract, but to win a Super Bowl. So I mean, you look at this, And you see time and time again in the NFL that when you draft these quarterbacks, it's hit or miss. And when it misses, I mean, you can fall into to that type of a NFL team year after year after year that goes after, look at Kansas City. I mean, they apparently, you know, they thought Matt Castle was going to be the next coming because he was under Tom Brady. And how could the Patriots be wrong? Because they drafted Brady to replace Bledsoe, and they were wrong. And why were they wrong? Because and Kevin Cobb, who has not had a great season. I mean, flashes of brilliance are not brilliant. They are flashes of brilliance. It's a gamble. I mean, a brilliant career Kevin Cobb did not have. He played at a school that was not a powerhouse. So when, where, how, you know, how is are these NFL teams creating the allure of the free agent quarterback? It needs to be, and it ought to be reexamined.
And let's bring in now former NBA star and one of the stars of ESPN's 30 for 30 documentary, Unguarded, Chris Herron. Chris, how are you, sir?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm doing very well, doing very well. Good to have you on.
Good to be on.
And Chris, I watched the documentary, and one thing I noticed about it, you said one of the things that came out of it, drink, drug, and fight is what you do and what you look up to in Fall River. And Fall River kind of reminds me of one of those towns where you can't stay forever. Can't stay forever. Otherwise, you'll run into a lot of problems. Is that the case?
Well, I mean, listen. There's a lot of people that don't run into problems in Fall River. I think when, you know, you're predisposed to addiction to that lifestyle, running hard, running fast. You know, those things tend to happen. You know, they go hand in hand. So. That's what was in with my case. You know, drinking led to fighting led to, you know, other things, and it was just something that that I believe was lifestyle that I was living there. You know, Fall River. You know, I've said many times that, you know, I've got high in six different foreign countries. You know, Tehran, Iran. You know, so, you know, at the end of the day, it was me. Not Fall River.
And Chris, I was again referencing the documentary. Your mother said that basketball became like a runaway train in your household, and she wanted to stop it, but it kept going. When you were young, did you kind of want to stop that train?
Oh, many times. Many times. Many times I walked away from it. You know, there were many times I left practice and told my mother I didn't want to do this anymore. And she saw, you know, she witnessed, you know, the high level of stress and expectations that came along with, you know, my talent. And, you know, but most of it, to be quite honest with you, was self-induced. You know, a lot of pressure, a lot of stress was self-imposed. And, you know, it was my own doing because, you know, growing up in Fall River and watching the history of Durfee basketball, watching the success of my brother, you know, I wanted to be better, you know, and I strived to be better, and I did things, you know, I pushed myself to be better. So a lot of it came from within.
And your brother said in the documentary he regretted drinking with you as you started drinking back in high school. And granted, you're in high school at the time, but did you realize at that point that you may have a problem, or you were just too young to even realize it?
You know, see, cocaine was tricky for me because, drinking cocaine, that lifestyle was tricky because, you know, I played AAU basketball. I played 85 games a summer. I wasn't drinking every weekend. I wasn't, you know, if you looked at me in high school, you wouldn't say like, oh man, that kid's going to leave, you know, his life's going to end up the way it ended up. And I think that's a cautionary tale to it. And I try to express that to kids when I speak to them, college kids, high school kids, you know, that I was busy most of the time. I was playing ball, so there wasn't a lot of drinking going on. I had friends that were drinking a lot more than me. But, you know, and when cocaine entered the equation, you know, although it is, you know, obviously a terrible drug, I thought that, you know, going out on a Friday, Saturday night you know, and sleeping it off till Sunday, Monday morning, and not picking it up for another month, 2 months, I thought that was okay. And it wasn't until I jumped into the opiate world that, you know, I realized that addiction had me by my throat.
Wow.
Well, Chris, I mean, you had just talked a little bit about, you know, cocaine. Was that, I mean, they oftentimes they'll say it's marijuana, but was cocaine then your gateway drug? Was it your safe drug to say, well, I can always go back to that and it not be a problem for me?
No, I don't think so. Listen, I think marijuana is something as simple as marijuana is a gateway drug. And again, that's what I expressed to kids, that, you know, I remember being in the eighth grade and being scared to drink alcohol for the first time. And I did it, and the fear was gone. And I remember being a freshman in high school and watching friends roll up a joint and being scared to death to smoke it. And I did. And then, you know, those walls break down, you know, and slowly but surely, you know, all the drugs come up. You know, I tell kids that all the time. You know, you think marijuana, you know, is innocent. You know, marijuana, the guys I was buying weed off when I was 16 years old became coke dealers at 22. You know, I mean, that's just the way that lifestyle evolves. And, you know, and that's the crowd I was with.
Well, I mean,
you talked about that, Chris, and one thing, you snorted your first line of cocaine at the age of 18 at Boston College. From there,
yeah.
How much were you snorting cocaine at Boston College from that point on?
See, it wasn't a daily thing for me. You know, it would be, you know, maybe twice a month, three times a month. You know, I would get into it. I'd go out on a night. You know, I'd go out drinking one night with my buddies and, you know, and swear that I wasn't gonna do any coke. And, you know, the alcohol broke down that wall. And next thing you know, it was 2, 3, 4 in the morning. And I was starting up on a bender and, you know, not finishing until 2 days later. So I am the type of person and my makeup that, you know, once I stop, there is no stopping. You know, I don't want to stop. You know, I don't care how early it is. I don't care if the sun's up. You know, I don't care if people are going to work. You know, I'm out running hard trying to get the next one. So that's just the way I was, and that's why it was so difficult.
And in hindsight, going to Boston College and kind of being close to Fall River, was that a mistake?
You know, was it a mistake? I like to think that there's always a plan, and you know what I went through at BC. There were lessons learned. You know, I crossed paths with people that, you know, although it didn't resonate with me then, and the lesson learned then did not apply immediately. I believe that, you know, it applied later on in life. So, you know, Boston College is an amazing school. It's a great school. Sometimes with my, you know, me doing cocaine for the first time at BC, I almost feel bad saying it because, you know, BC
right.
is an amazing, amazing, amazing school. And I would be more than honored and grateful that if my son went to BC. So sometimes BC kind of gets the bad rap tied into this, and I don't like that, and I don't mean that. I believe that it would have happened if I was at Harvard, MIT, anywhere. You know, I probably would have crossed paths with it.
We're talking to Chris Herron, former NBA guard, and Chris was the subject of ESPN's 30 for 30 documentary, Unguarded. And Chris also has the book out, Basketball Junkie, so make sure you get that as well. And Chris, you went on to Fresno State with Jerry Tarkanian, and I watched the documentary, and I saw Jerry Tarkanian and your relationship, and it almost seemed like a father-son type of relationship. Talk about your relationship with Coach Tarkanian.
Oh, it's an amazing relationship. He was very good to me. You know, I mean, that high-level college basketball is a business. I mean, and that's a fact. You know, it's a business. And, you know, sometimes, you know, at 18 years old, kids kind of can fall by the wayside in the game and just kind of be forgotten. You know, BC was willing to forget me, and that's okay. I understand they have a strict policy. Coach Tarkanian took a different approach. Fresno State took a different approach. They put me into treatment centers. They gave me counseling. They sent me to meetings. They did everything in their power to help me in that lifestyle. I just wasn't ready. And again, you look back now, and you know, my assistant coach at that time, John Welch, who was the first assistant with the Denver Nuggets now, he did everything to keep me on the right track. And he called me recently after Unguarded and after the book came out, and he apologized to me saying, like, I wish I did more. And I said, you did more than what you should have done. And, you know, I said, but just know that you're a big part of my sobriety today because I remember all those attempts you made. And just like Coach Tarkanian, he made countless attempts to help me. You know, and I said to him on the phone, you know, if you planted the seed many, many times in my head, in my heart. And you know, although it didn't apply at 21 years old, I believe it applied at 32, you know.
Well, and you bring up some interesting points that people throughout time, and you certainly talk about, you know, players on the Denver Nuggets who really try to, you know, take you and take care of you and do their best with you. And at certain points, you get traded to the Celtics and you start using, you know, OxyContin. And I think it's important as you talk about your book and you do a lot of the mentoring, and you said that you at that point weren't ready, you know, to face your addiction. And explain, you know, how difficult is it to know when people are trying to help you, or were you aware that you just weren't ready, you know, to face your addiction?
When was I ready to face it?
Was there a point where you knew that you were not ready? Did you, I mean, when you talk about addiction?
I was never ready. You know, and that's the, you know, I talk to people all the time, and people look at me and say, like, you know, I just don't know if I'm ready to go to treatment, Chris. And I'm saying, like, nobody's ready to go to treatment. You know, I mean, I wasn't ready to go to treatment, you know, and face what I've had to face, you know, in a sober light. That's extremely difficult to do. And you know, especially, I mean, when I was 21 years old, man, I sat in AA meetings and I sat in treatment centers and I looked around at people and I was like, oh man, these people are twisted. You know, like you got to be kidding me, dude. Like this is never gonna, I'm never gonna turn out to be these people. You know, and I look back at that room, I can rewind myself and look back at that room, and if I was sitting in that room at 35 years old, I'd be the worst one in the room. You know, so.
Wow.
You know, I wasn't ready until I got in there and I started doing the work and started looking at things and started forgiving myself and started getting rid of the guilt and saying, you know something, today's a new day and I'm going to make it a better day, and the next day and the next day, and they started piling up. And then, you know, the rest is history on a day-to-day basis.
And, Chris, another amazing story from the documentary. You went outside in your Celtics uniform waiting for a dealer. Percentage-wise, I mean, how many games do you think you played in the NBA high?
With the Celtics, when I played, I was playing high. I mean, there's no doubt about it. And I couldn't play unless I was high. You know, people, huh? The perception of Oxy, the perception of heroin is the guy sleeping. You know, I mean, that wasn't the case. You know, if I wasn't high, I would have been in a fetal position curled up, not touching a basketball. So I had to play under the influence.
And what was the lowest point for Chris Herron? I mean, you've been through a lot. You OD'd a few times. But what was the lowest point throughout this whole addiction?
You know, the lowest point was when I went home to, I was 40 days sober, and I went home to see my son Drew be born, and thinking that I had this addiction lit, and I didn't listen to the counselors, and they said only go home for a couple hours and come right back, and I said, you know, I'm going to stay a couple of days, and I got high that night. I mean, I watched my son be born. I watched, you know, my two kids go in and meet their brother, and I walked out, and went right to the liquor store. You know, I wasn't home for more than 3 hours, and then I was drinking and getting high that night. So when I walked back in the hospital the next day, my wife looked at me and knew that I was under the influence and told me I wasn't welcome. You know, she looked at me with disgust and said, you know, she didn't want me there. And, you know, it was something that, you know, hit me hard in my soul and my core. And when I went back there, you know, the counselor said, you know, why don't you do yourself a favor, call your kids, call your wife, tell them this is the last time you'll ever talk to them. Please move on with yourself, and that you were going to disappear. And I thought that night, you know, I laid in bed thinking that might be the best option for myself, for my wife, for my children, that I just totally disappear out of their life.
Did you ever think you would make it to this point now where you're sober?
No, absolutely not.
Wow.
Never. You know, not when I was at the end. I never thought I would be able to turn the ship around. You know, and because I was unwilling to make attempts at turning it around. I was unwilling to give it a shot. You know, I wasn't, you know, going to treatment centers, going to rehabs, didn't even cross my mind. You know, I thought I could, you know, my addiction was gonna kill me or put me in jail.
Right. And it came very close to doing that, putting you in jail.
Sure.
And killing
sure.
you as well.
Yeah.
We're talking to Chris Herron, former NBA player, and Chris is the subject of the ESPN 30 for 30 documentary, Unguarded. Also, Chris has a book out, Basketball Junkie, and make sure you check that book out. Very interesting story, a great, great story here. And Chris, I look at it now. You've been sober now for over 3 years. Talk about the day-to-day struggle and fighting this addiction.
See, you know, I think that is, for me, only applying to me, is that that question is frequently asked. Almost everybody asks the question, and it's almost phrased the exact way you just phrased it. You know, the day-to-day struggle. My man, the day-to-day struggle was pawning, you know, my valuable. You know, the day-to-day struggle was setting up syringes and putting it in my arm. You know, mm-hmm. smoking cigarettes out of public ashtrays and guzzling pints of vodka. That's a struggle. You know, this life of sobriety is like heaven, man. This is amazing. You know, I don't walk around, you know, thinking, you know, I want to get high every 5 minutes. You know, that's the struggle. This, mm-hmm. you know, this life is a blessing. You know, and I walk around not with the with a healthy fear of going back to that. So I maintain, you know, my program and my step work and I do stuff to kind of keep me on the right track. But the struggles in addiction, you know, the beauty is in recovery.
Yeah, that's a great point. Go ahead, Jeremy.
No, I was just saying it was a very interesting way to put it. And you had just mentioned here that, you know, every day now for you has been a blessing. And when you look, you know, day to day, how far do you plan, you know, your life in advance? Oftentimes you hear that you do live, you know, most ads try to live very short term because that was what can get them into trouble is forgetting about, you know, what one step is in front of them.
You know, can you say that one more time, please?
When you read about, like, your book was very interesting, and actually you've been on the media circuit and you've told a lot of stories. And
sure.
You know, the old Chris Herron, there was so much and has been so much made about your addiction. And I guess it's been talk about, you know, how you go about each day in sober life. You know, what keeps you so grounded?
Well, I mean, it's what keeps me grounded is obviously, I mean, I have three beautiful kids, a beautiful wife. You know, that definitely keeps me grounded. But also knowing that staying connected to recovery, staying connected to this life and helping others, you know, like paying it forward. You know, it's just something that is part of me. You know, I know what it's like, man, to have no more money. I know what it's like to have a lot of money. I know what it's like to have no money. I know what it's like to have no food, no heat, no hot water, no light, you know. I know I did a lot of bad things. But I also know that wasn't me. You know, that was a person struggling with a serious illness and a disease. And that's why I stay so connected, and that's what keeps me grounded in this is, you know, that my work and others and passing this message forward and that's the main focus of me staying who I am.
And Chris, you said something very interesting in the documentary. You said basketball was not your destiny. Talk about that. Explain that.
Well, I never found a certain peace in it. You know, I never went to the gym like, man, I can't wait to get to the gym. Every time I went to the gym, it was like, man, I got to go to the gym. You know what I mean? And from a very early age, it was not fun for me. Now that being said, did I ever take a crack at it sober? No.
Right.
So maybe it would be different. Maybe today it'd be different if I went at it sober, you know. But I'm 36 years old; those days are over. But I'll tell you, I find an amazing amount of peace doing what I do today. You know, I mean, I'm involved with basketball. I have the gyms going. You know, I'm around kids. You know, I'm teaching them. You know, the guys who work for me. You know, we're training them and getting them ready to play. But my heart is with addicts. You know, my heart and soul is with addicts, and that's just the way it is for me. And that's where I find my peace today. That's where I find my comfort is holding out my hand and picking somebody up. You know what I mean? Because if Chris Mullin and his wife didn't pick me up when I was down, I probably would be dead today. And
wow.
if I wasn't dead, then I'd be in jail. And if I wasn't in jail, I would have lost my family. So that simple phone call, him calling me in the hospital that day and saying, I got a place for you to go. Get in the car tomorrow. It's going to drive you right to it. If he didn't extend that hand that day and do that for me, I'd be dead today. So for me, I'm willing to extend my hand anytime. Because if it can connect a grown man or a grown woman back to her children and connect them as a family again. Come on, man. What's better than that? Is better than any trophy?
I agree
than any trophy,
with
any headline, any uniform you ever put on. So that's magic.
And talk about, you talked about some of the things you're doing with basketball. Talk about some of the other things that you're doing right now.
Well, again, I think that, I'm not the type of guy who's into self-promoting. You know, that's not my style. You know, I don't believe this is I don't believe that what I've gone through and all the media that I'm doing now because of this documentary and because of the book, you never hear me saying out loud, you know, this is who I am, this is my company, this is what I do. I don't even usually name the company. But you know, the nonprofit is the Heron Project, and that is, you know, that's the most important thing for me, because what I do is I, you know, raise money from whoever, and we have an account, and when people call me and are willing to go to treatment, we pay for it, and we pay for their treatment for them to go in.
That's
great. I don't know any drug addict or any alcoholic that puts a piggy bank aside or a bank account and says, you know, I'm gonna save some dough up. I'm gonna save some dough up for when I hit rock bottom. You know what I mean?
Right.
And on top of it, I was a dope fiend. I was a heroin addict. The insurance that I would, if I had insurance at the time, I would get 4 days of treatment. Now, I just ran the streets for 10 years, and you're going to give me 4 days to get my life back? You know, what the Heroin Project does, it brings in private donations, and when people call, I have contracts with different substance abuse centers. When people call and they need some help, I'll pay, but it's got to be extended treatment. So anywhere between 30 and 90 days, they get sent away and the treatment's paid for.
And, Chris, where can we find information about Basketball Junkie, the book?
Amazon. It's all over Amazon. You know, Barnes & Noble has it. You know, Borders did in the beginning before it went bankrupt. But it's on Amazon, so you can get it there.
And real quickly now, Chris, you talked about Chris Mullen and how he helped you. Talk about your wife. I mean, your wife to me, and watching that documentary, she seemed like she was your rock.
Oh, man, of course she is. You know, that's what everybody says. I mean, I'm going through airports and guys are saying, man, you know, your wife is a saint, you know, you know, she's a special person. You know, she looked at it as an illness. She looked at it as if I had cancer. And, you know, she was gonna stick it out. Now, you know, and she will tell you that she was very close to saying, you know, you're making everyone else sick around you, and walking away. But I thank God every day for her. I thank God because, you know, I get to kiss my kids goodbye at night and wake them up in the morning to go to school. You know, that's amazing.
Chris, I mean, it was your story is amazing. It was a pleasure talking to you, man, and nothing but the best of luck for you moving forward.
Thank you.
Keep doing what you're doing. Keep telling your story, man, and you're changing lives. Keep it up.
Thank you. I appreciate your time, fellas. I'll talk to you.
All right. Take care.
Take care. All right.
Chris Heron, great story. Great, great, great story. An amazing story, actually. You can listen to this show and other shows at blogtalkradio.com/PGAN, where you can listen to this great show and other great shows. Make sure you follow the show on Twitter at GoForItGAN. For everybody here at GoForIt, Jeremy Espy, and everybody here at GoForIt, we wish you nothing but the best of luck. Hope you have a great day. Thanks for listening. See you later. Take care. Bye.